This week is a double parsha of Behar and Bechukotai. Behar deals with primarily the laws of Shemitah, the laws of the seventh year, which is the sabbatical year of the land. Torah tells us we work for 6 years, and the seventh year the land remains fallow. It's hefker, anyone can take whatever grows from the land. It's really an ownerless year. The Torah then tells us the law of the Yovel, the Jubilee, where you count 7 times 7. There's a lot of mystical significance to this, that you get to the 49th year, which is the 7th year of the cycle of Shemitah. And then the 50th year is Yovel, another year where you don't work the land. It's like a double header, 2 years in a row. And it's a time when all the slaves go free and all the land returns to its original owners. And a lot of Parshat Behar deals with real estate. What year you buy the land in will depend on what year it is to the Yovel. It gets cheaper as you're closer to the Yovel because you're going to return the land back to its original owner. So here we have a lot of details of real estate that are found in our parsha. Parsha Behar also deals with a lot of the interpersonal relationships in terms of if your brother does not have money to support him, to redeem his field for him, and a lot of the laws of tzedakah, of charity, are found here as well. Parsha Bechukotai then deals with the famous bracha on klalos. We have it twice in the parsha. We always read it 2 weeks before Shavuos or 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah. It deals with the blessing and curse if you follow. In Bechukotai Telecho, if you follow the Torah, these are the wonderful things that will happen. And if you don't follow the Torah, well, then these are the consequences. And the end of Bechukotai deals with the laws of Erechin, the laws of the value of a person, how much is a person worth if they want to give their value as a sacrifice to the temple. So there's a tremendous amount here. So I'm going to follow the rule I've been following throughout, more or less. And that is, when you don't know where to begin, always begin at the beginning. And that way you're always safe. So I guess next year we'll do the third and fourth pasuk. And, you know, over a cycle of a couple of hundred years, we'll finish all the parshiyos. Let's take a look at the first pasuk, the first two pasukim in Parshas Behar. We're only going to be dealing really with Parshas Behar today. Raise a number of questions and then try to get an approach on understanding 3 levels of an answer. The pasuk begins, this is source 1, where Hashem spoke to Moshe at Mount Sinai, telling him to speak to the Israelites and say to them, and this is the command of Shemitah, when you come to the land that I am giving you, the land must be given a rest period, a Shabbat to God. For 6 years you may plant your field, prune your vineyards, and harvest your crops, but the 7th year is a Shabbat of the Shabbats of the land. It is God's Shabbat, during which you may not plant your fields, nor prune your vineyards, etc. Do not harvest your crops, etc. So the first question, and it's a very famous question, it's a question that Rashi brings down on the spot. The question is, Ma'inyan Shemitah Eitel Har Sinai. Why is this section, which details for us the law of Shemitah, the law of what we will call the sabbatical year, why does it begin with the prelude of God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai? Well, did God not speak all the laws that we have to God at Mount Sinai? So the answer is yes. All the mitzvot that we have weren't, you know, thought up at different periods of time. They all originated at Sinai. So if all the laws originated at Sinai, so how come it's only by Shemitah that we underscore that God spoke to Moshe at Har Sinai and told them to do the following? If this was found by every mitzvah, so I wouldn't have a question. The idea is that it's only by Shemitah do we have that this was told at Har Sinai, and here's the mitzvah of Shemitah. What is the connection? Na'inyan Shemitah etzal Har Sinai. What is the connection between Shemitah and Har Sinai that the two are connected? So Rashi gives the following answer, source number 2. Rashi quotes Tzaris Kohanim asking, why is Mount Sinai mentioned specifically in connection with the mitzvah of the sabbatical year Shemitah? The reply given by Rabbi Akiva is that Shemitah is here to symbolize all the other mitzvahs. Just as the details of Shemitah, in addition to its broad outlines, were given to Moses at Mount Sinai, so were those of all the other mitzvahs. So says Rashi, why is Shemitah chosen? To show you that just like Shemitah, Dikdu Geha, all its details were given at Mount Sinai, so learn from that that all mitzvahs were given at Mount Sinai, including their detail. Then the question we have on Rashi is what? Why Shemitah? I could say that about any law, right? I could put down Shabbos, I could put down Kashrus, I could put down any law. And we would ask, well, why is this law by Har Sinai? Well, to teach us that X law was set at Mount Sinai, so all the laws were set at Mount Sinai. Great! that still doesn't respond to the question of why was Shemitah chosen of all the mitzvahs for that to be the mitzvah to be connected with Mount Sinai. Okay, so that's question one. Question one, what is it about the nature of Shemitah that there's some intrinsic connection to Mount Sinai? Question number two is in the phrase at the end of the second verse that it's a Shabbat to God. And here Rashi notes, this is source three, on Shabbat la Hashem, he says, it's l'shem Hashem, it's for God, k'shem she'ne'mar b'Shabbat reishit. Just like it speaks about that there's a Shabbos to God, about the Shabbos that we normally call Shabbos, the seventh day of the week, the Sabbath. So we see from Rashi that the Shemitah year is somehow, by the language of the Torah, intrinsically connected to the concept called Shabbos. What is the connection between Shemitah and Shabbos? So you'll say to me, very easy. Shabbos we stop working, Shemitah we stop working. I grant you that. But I want to look a little bit deeper of what is the philosophical connection between Shabbos and Shemitah. And finally, the third question, which comes from this week's Pirkei Avos, the fifth chapter, where the Mishnah says, this is brought down in source 4, that exile comes upon the world on account of four things. Golos, the Jews being thrown out of their land, comes because of four things. Idolatrous worship, Avodah Zarah, incense, Giloy Arayos, and Shvichos Damim, adultery, and Shvichos Damim, bloodshed. That makes sense. The major three things. These are Yehereg Vayavor. You have to, you know, at all costs keep these three things, even at the hands of death. I can understand. So if you're going to not be careful about these three things, so then you're worthy of Golos. But then the Mishnah brings the fourth thing, almost out of the blue. And what's the fourth thing that, if you fail to do so, will cause Golos? The sabbatical year of the soil. Not keeping Shemitah is going to be the fourth thing that's going to be cause of Golos. And as Rabbi Bunim quotes from the Medrash and the Ramban in sources 5 and 6, that indeed the Jewish people, as quoting from the Ramban, were exiled after the first temple period for 70 years to parallel the 10 cycles of Shemitah they did not keep. And that's why the exile period was the exact amount of the time that they did not keep the sabbatical years in Israel. But the question remains, is this source 7. But is Shemitah really as serious and important as idol worship and morality and bloodshed to warrant the same severe consequences? I mean, you're placing it up with the top three. Is Shemitah, not keeping Shemitah, that terrible a thing that it should warrant Golos? So just to reiterate our questions. Question number one is, what is the nature of Shemitah that is connected so intrinsically with Mount Sinai? What's the connection between Shemitah and Shabbos? And finally, why is Shemitah up there with the top three that would warrant the Jews being sent into Golos? There are many, many approaches to all three questions. I'd like to take a look at three approaches. One focusing on the law itself, one focusing on the people keeping the law, and one focusing on the land. So to look at it from three different perspectives. Very fascinating. Perspective number one. Sounds in the writings of Nissen Alpert, Limudei Nisan, source number 8. V'kanna tamid shoel, mahu halimud hazeh. At this point, when looking at the first Rashi, a student may ask, well, what am I supposed to learn from this? Just like the details were given at Mount Sinai by the law of Shemitah, so too all the details were given at Mount Sinai. Why was Shemitah chosen? So he says very beautifully in source 9. We know that there's a mitzvah to remember every day, Mamad Har Sinai, the experience of Mount Sinai. And it's something that we should teach our children about, this experience. And part of this experience, he notes, is what we say in the Shema every day, V'hayu hadvarim ha'ela asher anochi mitzavcha hayom, that you should keep the laws that I'm commanding you today. And as Rashi notes, based on our rabbis, Hayom today, well, I didn't command you today, I commanded you thousands of years ago. So what do we mean by today? But rather, Shebechol yom vayom yu beinecha kachadashim, every day we should look at it as if Torah is new. Har Sinai represents for us, and every day to recall Har Sinai represents for us, that mitzvah observance should be looked at as if today we got the Torah. Wow, today we got the Torah. Today we were commanded with a certain mitzvah, so therefore there's a certain passion and enthusiasm that I'll have to do it. Anytime we know this to be true, anytime something is new, it's exciting. Right? You get a new outfit or you make a new purchase, whatever it is. So the first time you use it, wow, there's a certain excitement in the air. What happens after using that outfit, or let's say wearing that outfit, I don't know, for the 20th time? Oh, that again. You know, like a little bit tired of it, you know? It's like it's still in the closet, haven't gotten rid of it yet, right? So he says the following. He says, okay, that's a very nice idea, that every day we should look at Torah and mitzvot as if today we were given it. But hold on. Practically speaking, he says, where the asterisk is a 9, the Yeshli Kmo, can't we but wonder? Ech efshar lidrosh mibnei adam, how can we expect of people? Shelachar shasa maaseh ha-mitzvah yoter me'elef pamim, after you've done something 1,000 times. Yaseh otav bo'tayitz chatshut kibipama rishonah, do you really honestly expect us to have the same passion, enthusiasm of doing it the first time? Let's get real. It's not practical. Yeah, the question is understood. So it gives the following approach based on the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish says the following. She'im yizaher v'itakdek lasot ha-mitzvah b'shleimuta b'chol prateh v'diktukeha yiyeh b'inav k'chadasha. Here's the following advice. Says the Chazon Ish, you know a way to get out of this bind? Do a mitzvah being sensitive to all the details of the mitzvah. If you're sensitive and careful about all the aspects of the mitzvah, you research the mitzvah, you understand the different components that are involved in the mitzvah, so then you're not just not going to do it by rote. There's going to be a certain amount of insight, and that insight is going to lead to enthusiasm. Get out of the habit mode by learning about it. And every mitzvah has different nuances. Something as simple as saying a blessing over a shahakal, over a cup of water. But if we realize that we should be taking it in our right hand, and we should sit down when we say a blessing, and we just think about what the words of the blessing is, so suddenly that blessing that I say so automatically, stop a second. If I have to sit down, I should hold it in my right hand. Oh, whoa. That causes the person to think about what they're doing, pause for a second. And that's why Shemitah is chosen. What's unique about Shemitah? He says in any given lifetime, most, let's say an average, a person lives 70, 80 years, how many Shemitahs do they keep in their lifetime? 10, 11 Shemitahs? Not too many. So what happens, and this is true, we even see in our day and age when people are careful about the laws of Shemitah. For 6 years, we're preparing and learning about what to do on the 7th year. And then there's a proliferation of all these books and pamphlets and videos, and everyone's into the Shemitah year. There's a real excitement going on. Ever been to Israel in the Shemitah year? You'll see it, right? It's a big hoo-ha the year before, the year during, the year after, because it happens once every 7 years. So you make a big deal about it. He says that's why Shemitah's chosen. Because Shemitah, with all of its details, which is not kept so often, and there's an automatically a certain passion about the law of Shemitah that we're more inclined to keep with its details, that therefore serves as a model for us on how to look at all the mitzvot, that we should look at it with that same enthusiasm and all the details of mitzvot that are even more common than the mitzvah of Shemitah. And that's why, says the Shem Yishmuel, in source number 11, that this is included in those top three of mitzvahs that you get thrown out of the land. Why? He says, why does a person, or do the Jewish people get thrown out of their land? So the pasuk in Devarim tells us, Tachasher lo avata, Hashem Elokecha, besimcha ubetuv levav mirov kol, because you did not serve God with joy and with happiness from all the goodness God gave you. And he says where the asterisk is, v'yadua ki simcha ba'avoda nitzmecha mehitchadshut. Where does simcha, joy, come from, right? You're going to be punished because you don't serve God with joy. And this is a beautiful definition of joy for our own lives as well. What is the essence of joy? Hitchadshut, renewal, newness. When something is new, when something is, you feel invigorated, renewed, that leads to a certain amount of simcha. And that's why he says, Shemitah is an inyan of hitchatshus. Shabbos every week is a hitchatshus, as we'll speak about later today, a renewal of creation. Torah has to always be looked at as new. And therefore, Shemitah, as being one of the four, symbolizes a lack of enthusiasm and passion for the service of God. So it's almost like there are three negative things you've done: idol worship, immorality, murder. And then the fourth thing represents all of the positive mitzvot. These are the three negative. And it's, the Shemitah represents the positive mitzvot which lacked this hitchatshut, this renewal, this newness, this passion, this enthusiasm. And since we didn't have this enthusiasm, that's why we lack simcha and we're thrown out of the land. Before we go on, I'd like to share an example of a mitzvah in our parsha, a very, very practical mitzvah for our lives, which I think if we would but just heed the words of the Chazon Ish and realize the depth of this mitzvah, we would see how much more concern and insight it would lead within our own lives to keeping this mitzvah. What's the law? Very, very practical. Source 12. Each of you shall not aggrieve his fellow, and you shall fear your God, for I am Hashem your God. This is the mitzvah of ona'ah. Ona'ah means to aggrieve, to oppress another person. We have earlier in Parshas Dvarim what's called ona'as mamon, oppressing someone with money, not having fair and legal weights. It would be like in a store putting the best grapes on top and then in that same bag putting the not so grapes, good grapes on the bottom. And then when the person comes in and says, ooh, good bunch of grapes. And you look through the top and it looks very nice and you buy the whole batch. And when you get home, what do you find? All the rotten ones beneath. I mean, there have been many recent investigations done in certain supermarkets that we're familiar with. All these things where they take day-old meat, put barbecue sauce on it, and then repackage it and put on a new date. So it's as if this is, you know, it smells good, it's brand new meat. This is what we're talking about, onas mamon, oppressing somebody with money. But then our parasha deals with something even more deeper. And that's called onas dvarim, oppressing somebody with words. And here, I'd like to try to understand today the depth of this halacha, so we should be more careful. The examples that the Talmud brings of onas dvarim, let's take a look in source 13. In addition to the prohibition of onas mamon, cheating one's fellow man monetarily by overcharging or underpaying, the Torah also prohibits various forms of onas dvarim, what we call verbal deceit. Onas dvarim takes many forms: inviting someone for a meal knowing that he'll be out of town on that day, inquiring about the price of merchandise when one has no intention of buying, but only wishes to compare it to the price of an item already purchased. Reminding a Baal Teshuva of his previous sins, telling a person who is suffering misfortune that he's being punished for his sins. And as Rabbi Leff notes in 14, in the first two cases of onas dvarim, the element of deceit is relatively clear-cut. Inviting someone knowing they cannot accept, one creates a sense of reciprocal obligation on their part. I invited you. Now the least you could do is what? Invite me back, knowing very well that they're going to be out of town. Similarly, posing as a would-be customer causes the merchant to waste his time and effort in anticipation of a would-be sale. And we often find this happens. So we buy something, and then we go into pass by a store, and we say, oh, I just got this. Let me go in and see how much it costs. So if you're going to go in and tell the salesperson, you know, I just purchased this item, I'm curious to know how much you're selling it for, that's far different. And saying, oh, really, how much is it? And does it have this gadget and that gadget? And the person is under the impression that indeed you're going to buy it when you have no interest in buying it. Let's say you can't return the other object. This is called onas dvarim, making a person feel bad. It's on a very sublime level, but this is the sensitivity that the Torah demands from us. So this is level one. Level one is what's the connection between Shemitah and Har Sinai, the concept of hitchatshus, the concept of newness, the concept of passion, because Shemitah doesn't happen that often, So you have that newness, you have that passion, and it's for the lack of hitchatshus, the lack of simcha, that was the cause of galus. Let's take a look at approach number two, which is not based on the law, but rather based on the people keeping the law. This is based on the writings of Sfas Emes, where he says the following. The Medrash says, verse 15, that the verse, "Bless the Lord, O His angels, powerful heroes who do His word," refers to those who observe the sabbatical year. The rabbis also taught us that when Israel said, "We shall do, before we shall listen, Na'aseh v'nishvan by Mount Sinai," the Blessed One said, "Who revealed to my children that secret used by my ministering angels." When the children of Israel received the Torah, they were prepared to become like angels above. After all, lower creatures are also God's emissaries. All of us were created for God's glory. The difference is that the angel is nothing else, only to do God's will, and for us, it's a choice. So when we were at Mount Sinai, we reached this level of angels, the level of angels being that we took our free choice and in a sense practiced what's called bittul, we nullified our will for God's will. And that's why he says that we were given manna to eat, which is the food of angels. We had reached high levels. And he continues, and this is very fascinating, in the arrow in 16. But even after they sinned by worshipping the golden calf, there remained for Israel times when this former power is awakened. This time where we reached Adam before the sin, where we reached the level where we're able to give ourselves up totally for God. One such time is Shabbos, when we set aside all other tasks and are prepared only to serve the blessed God. And that's why the food on Shabbos is considered holy food. It has a special, on a Hasidic level, a Kabbalistic level, has a special taste and sense to it. And where we also see this is 17, during sabbatical and jubilees. As on Shabbat, Israel enjoys some of their former enlightenment from before their sin. That is why they rest at these times to return to their former rung that they attained at Mount Sinai. This is a wonderful interpretation of a verse. This is the true freedom of the Jubilee of which it says, "You shall return each man unto his possession." What is his possession? It's back to our original root of Mount Sinai. It's coming back to who we are. Ish el achuzato. What is our root? What is our possession? It's that time at Mount Sinai where we felt so connected to God that we're able to really step back from ourselves for God. That's the Shemitah year. If you think about it logically, the Shemitah year makes absolutely no sense. If man were to have written the Torah, so how would if he created the Shemitah year? Very simply. He would divide up the land into parts. Every part would rest. You don't wait 7 years to rest. You wait 1 or 2 years, give the land a break. But you do it in cycles. So these poor guys don't have food, but the middle people have food. And then when these guys have food, the middle guys don't. And that way you rotate the land and everyone has food. To create a law where it's not after 1 or 2 years you let the land rest, but after 6 hard years you let it rest. But which part of the land rests? The entire part. Everyone has no food. And then comes the Jubilee, the Yovel, and for 2 years no one has food. It's crazy. This is what we talk about, the level of angels, where if you really have the Tachon and the Moon on God, and that's really a major theme of this parasha, that if you're able to withhold your will for God's will, and you say, even though I don't understand it, I'm nevertheless going to do it. Why is it connected to Mount Sinai? Because it shares with Mount Sinai that same experience of Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do, and then we will understand that we will withhold our own intellect and do God's will. And it's interesting that he adds, it's also based on the Sforno in Source 18, it's fascinating, so we'll add it almost parenthetically. If we saw that the manna is the food that sustained the Jewish people, angel food, and Shabbos has special food, so too by Shemitah and Yovel you have that as well. The Torah tells us that if the people should ask, well, what are we going to eat? We're not working the land for 2 years. So God says, don't worry, I'll send down my blessing on you, have plenty of food. So explain to Sforno as well as others, if a person won't ask, if a person really believes that God will provide him the food, so then he will have a normal crop in the 6th year, but he'll have a blessing that that food will be sufficient and nourishing enough for him for 3 years. It will be like the man where a little bit of food will nourish him a lot. And yet, if he asks, and he's on a, so to speak, a lower level, even though it's a pretty high level, if he asks, well, I'm going to keep the laws, but what shall I eat? Only then will God do the miracle of giving more food. But then you're going to have to work for it. It's going to be a greater crop in the sixth year, but you have to work for it and bring in more, and it's going to take more effort on your part. If you're on a higher level, it will be less food, but it will sustain you. If you're on a lower level, it will be more food, and it will, you will see how it will sustain you. And this is echoed in Rav Gedaliah Shur in the Or Gedaliahu, who says that these, both Mount Sinai and Shemitah, is a law of, it's a concept of shtika, of being able to silence one's desires. And as he says at the bottom of 19, v'limsor et atzmo kulo l'kabalat ha-Torah, to give himself completely over, shibitlu v'ishtiku kol ha-ritzono v'shibdu atzmam l'kabalat ha-Torah. It's this concept called bitul, the concept of self-nullification and giving yourself up to God. What's the connection between Shemitah and Har Sinai in this level? Very simply, both form a model of giving up a self, of rational, intellectual self, for a higher will called God. It's this concept that I'd like to look at a little bit more in depth. I'd like to do it through a very fascinating article of Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, Majesty and Humility. Just going to do segments of the essay, but I think that the end of the essay and the upshot of the essay is exactly what we're speaking about today. So let's work through most of the essay, or parts of it, because it's very fascinating in its own right. He notes in Source 20 that there are two objectives which moral man pursues, and they're in opposite directions. And it's based on a wonderful, wonderful medrash, which Rashi quotes, in connection with the creation of man. In Source 21, the verse says, and God created man dust of the earth. That's where man came from. He came from dust. So the obvious question is, and it's not such a simple question, well, where did God get the dust to create man? Clearly, the dust that's going to create man is going to be what we call significant dust, if I could use such a phrase. So Rashi quotes two interpretations. And they're really not just interpretations. As we've been discussing, Medrash has to be understood much deeper. Interpretation number one is found in Source 22. God gathered the dust from which man was fashioned from the entire earth from its four corners. So God, kivyachol, as if, on a metaphysical, symbolic level, went to the four corners of the earth, took a little bit of dust from everywhere, brought it together and formed man. That's approach one. Approach number two is found in Source 23. He took the dust from which man was made from the spot which was designated by the Almighty at the very dawn of creation as a future site of the altar. It's at this point, the place where man would most connect with God, this is the place. From one location, he took the dust. One location, many locations. What's going on here? Much, much deeper. When it means, on one level, that God collected dust from the entire world, it means, Source 24, that man was created of cosmic dust. God gathered the dust of which man was fashioned from all parts of the earth, indeed from all the uncharted lanes of creation. Man belongs everywhere. He is no stranger to any part of the universe. And more than that, is the concept of man being created from the dust of the uncharted lanes means that man being created is meant to go to those places and to build up that world from that dust. That's our challenge. And that's why he discusses this first man, which he calls man of majesty, cosmic man. He discusses on Source 25, man is cosmic through his intellectual involvement, where he is constantly curious about the things in his own backyard, but also things far removed from him. 26, he is cosmic through his experiential involvement, where man is questing not only to know the universe, but also to experience it. 27, he's cosmic through his mobility, where he's able to move around. And that's how he explains the verse, which is a very famous verse in Source 28. Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh Lavo Mipanecha BaMatzor, which he translates as rhetorical question, is man like the tree of the field? Is the tree as mobile as man? Man's greatness, ceaseless mobility. So on the one hand, this is a dialectic that's found within all of us. There's part of us which is this man of majesty, this cosmic man that's created from the four corners of the world that wants to go out and conquer the world, and we're told, be like God, go out and conquer the world. Try to experience the world. Move, be mobile, do whatever you can to make this world into a better place. But then there's another part of us. And that's the man that was created from one location. 29. Let's examine the other interpretation of the verse in Genesis. Man was created from the dust of a single spot. Man is committed to one locus. The Creator assigned him a single spot he calls home. Man is not cosmic, he is here-minded. He is a rooted being. As he continues in 30, he is rooted in his nachalah, in his portion. He quests for his portion, for the origin. Because of this origin consciousness, he is curious to know everything about his roots, about the makor, the root which sustains his selfhood, that whole TV series Roots, right? It's that concept of knowing everything about yourself, but not outwardly, but very much inwardly, very much connected to one place on the ground. And that's how we would understand the verse, a man is like a tree in the field, as an affirmative statement. Man is indeed like the tree in the field, 31. Man is indeed a rooted being attached and committed to a homestead, no matter how far he may have traveled. And he goes on to discuss this, that both cosmos conscious man and origin conscious man quest for God, although they are not always aware of this quest. A man yearns for God both in his feverish haste to get farther and farther from home, and his loathsomeness for home and his experience of spell that home cast upon him. Cosmic man finds God, if ready for him, in the vastness and boundlessness of the cosmic drama, where homebound origin man finds God in the limitless and narrowness of finitude, in the smallness of the modest home to which he was born. God can be found in both places, going out into the world and very much within one's dalet amos, one's four cubic feet. What's the difference between the two? Cosmic man, 35, aims at majesty or kingship. Man is sovereignty, man wants to be king. Man is summoned by God to be ruler, to be king, to be victorious. And that's wonderful. And that's a call to move out and to conquer the world. However, there's another side to this. And that side is to imitate God in tzimtzum, in self-contraction, in withdrawing. And that's why he says in 36 that man must not always be victor. From time to time, triumph should turn into defeat. Man in Judaism was created for both victory and for defeat. He must know how to fight for victory and also how to suffer defeat. Modern man is frustrated and perplexed because he cannot take defeat. He is simply incapable of retreating humbly. And here's where the essence of what I wanted to get to is right now. 37. In what areas of human endeavor does Judaism recommend self-defeat? Self-defeat is demanded in those areas in which man is most interested, where the individual expects to find the realization of the most cherished dream or vision, where, in the opinion of pragmatic man, it is absolutely necessary for the individual to win. It is precisely in those areas that God requires man to withdraw. God tells man to withdraw from whatever man desires the most. It is true of the father of the nation. What was the most precious possession of Abraham? Was it not his son Yitzchak? And he was told to bring him up as a sacrifice. As much as we move forward, we need to understand that at times God tells us to retreat, to move inward, to move from the dust of the four corners to the dust of one location. Not only to be the man of majesty, but the man of humility as well. And this tension is a tension which exists really every day of our lives. As Rabbi Rucham in Das Torah explains, sources 38 through 41, the hour is late, so we'll just summarize, where he says that in life, God, so to speak, gives man the ability to be a bore umoshel, to go and create and rule. But however, God also tells the person, don't think that that gives you 100% carte blanche over the world. There will be times and many times that God will tell you, step back. Plant your field. Give part of it to the poor. Do whatever law it is, but I am going to tell you that there's going to come a time that if you're going to bake bread, give some to the priest. Whatever you do, wherever you move forward, there's always going to be places of retreat. And the reason for retreat is to remember that ultimately you are not in control of the world. There is that God who created you. And he says that the two prime examples where we have this concept where man really has to step back and really relinquish control. Right? By giving a piece of our bread, I still have most of the bread. By giving a tithe to my crops, I still have most of my crops. The two places where we see that man really needs to relinquish and step back is Shabbos and Shemitah. Go work your field. Have as much crops as you want. Do whatever you can for 6 years. Comes the seventh year, forget it. The land is mine. It belongs to me. I need you to understand that it belongs to me. Relinquish your rights over the land, but entirely. 6 days you want to work, do whatever you want. You want to be a workaholic and take showers in your office and have a 23-hour day, that's great. Come Shabbos, step back. Relinquish your control. That is the dialectic that we go through in life. This is why Shemitah, Shabbos are connected to Har Sinai, because Har Sinai is the paradigm of Naseh v'Nishma, where we give ourselves up to God. The commitment we made at Har Sinai is we will do, and then we will listen. However, says the Rav, the following. 42, and this is key. What happens after man makes this movement of recoil and retreat? God may instruct him to resume his march to victory and move onward in conquest and triumph. The movement of recoils redeems the forward movement, and the readiness to accept defeat purges the uncontrollable lust for victory. Once man has listened and retreated, he may later be instructed to march straight to victory. Abraham was told to withdraw and to defeat himself by giving Isaac away. He listened. God accepted Isaac, but did not retain him. God returned him to Abraham with the blessing, and thy seed shall take possession of his enemy's gate. As the Ramban notes, we have a promise that God will never wipe out the Jewish people as a result of this great trial. Abraham found victory in retreat. And this is the key. God isn't only asking us to step back, and then that's the end of the process. No! It's the stepping back, it's this realization that we have recognized that there is a master and maker over us. That after we step back, God then says, go forward, march on. And you're marching on and you're going forward. It will be a much greater march on, a much greater going forward, because you realize that you're doing it under the constraints, so to speak, of God's will. And that's the deeper insight of Shabbos and Shemitah. As the Nesiv HaShalom notes in Source 43, based on the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, is that in reality, God created a week just to last 6 days. What happens on Shabbos is this concept we mentioned earlier of Yitzchatshut, of newness, that on Shabbos we're then given a blessing that we'll now have 6 more days of the week. Shabbos is like the springboard for the next week. And we know this, depending on how our Shabbos is, that's how the next future week will be. If it was a really great Shabbos, so then you can expect a great week to come. That's why the concept of having an offer of the Shabbos before a wedding, it's the simcha of the week, of the Shabbos that's going to go into the week. And says to your Achaim HaKadosh, if there should be a Jew, or if there should be no Jews in the entire world keeping Shabbos ever, the world would come to an end. Because Shabbos gives the power of the next 6 days to exist. And the same thing applies to Shemitah. What allows the land to be able to produce fruit, what allows the Jewish people to live on the land, is Shemitah. It's stepping back for 1 year, whether it's stepping back on Shabbos or stepping back on the seventh year, that then gives the person the ability to have the next 6 days to work or have the next 6 years to work on the land. It's the stepping back that allows the person to be propelled much further in the future. And that's why it's no accident that when were the Jewish people exiled from their land? So our rabbis tell us, b'motzei shviz, right after the Shemitah year. Why? Because they weren't worthy of another round of 6 years. You didn't keep the Shemitah year? Goodbye. You aren't worthy of moving forward. That's why Shemitah is listed among those lists of why is Shemitah counted as one of the four? Because Shemitah is the whole reason that we are able to stay on the land. If you're able to step back, then you're able to have the gift of continuation. And I think that this applies as well to the concept of onas dvarim that we spoke about before. Sometimes onas dvarim means to step back and not to say everything we would like to say. It takes that movement of recoil, the movement of stepping back. But it goes even deeper than that. Rav Chaim Friedlander in Sifte Chaim in Source 45 notes that onas dvarim, part of onas dvarim, the suppression of people, is to walk around with a sour face. Because when you walk around with a sour face, what happens? You depress people around you. Wow. Wow. So if you happen to be in a bad mood, you're entitled to be in a bad mood. I'm giving you the bad mood. But that doesn't mean you need to share that bad mood with everyone around you. And we know that. If you walk around with a smile, what happens? It lights up the people you meet. When we're talking about a certain amount of self-control, it's also self-control of feeling. Be sensitive to the people you meet around you. They are affected by the way you look on your face. This is the depth of onas dvarim, the sensitivity that we need to have. Finally, I know the hour's late. Bear with me, one more idea. If we saw the connection on a level of the law itself of Shemitah, of Yitzchatshut, of Nunes, and we looked at it from a level of the people keeping it, let's very briefly look at it from the perspective of the land itself. And I'll do a lot of the sources outside because of our time constraint. Note Sios 9 Latorah in Source 46, that if you think about it, the law of Shemitah is very strange. Why? Because the Torah is careful about how we relate to God and their mitzvahs about between us and God. And their mitzvahs how we relate to parents and how we relate to teachers and the mitzvahs how we relate to other people. And their mitzvahs how we relate to animals, and I can understand all of that. Shows a sensitivity to everything around us. But sensitivity to land? Isn't that a bit much? We have to be careful about the land to allow the land to have a rest. Who cares about the land? People I can understand, even animals I can understand. But a land? Land is inanimate. So that's why the Nesiva Sholem points out in Source 47 and 48 that there are really three levels of Kedusha, three levels of holiness that exist. There's a holiness in the world, a holiness in time, and a holiness of a person. And the three that are found among the Jewish people is the holiness of Shabbos, the holiness of every individual Jew, as we spoke about, Kedoshim Tiyu, to be holy, and the holiness of the land of Israel, which we know has a special holiness. Therefore, says in the Nesiva Sholem, why was the law of Shemitah connected to the law of Mount Sinai? Because Mount Sinai showed us a paradigm of how a piece of land could attain holiness. That at that time when God came and gave the Torah, which happened also to be Shabbos, and we were elevated to a higher levels of Kedusha, we had at Har Sinai the real, the model of what holiness is about. Holiness of individuals, holiness of time, and holiness of place. Where anyone who would come up on the mountain would immediately be killed. God's presence was on the mountain. This is the ability to understand that, yes, a physical place can be holy. It exists. What's the connection between Shemitah and Har Sinai is to tell you that just like Har Sinai, you have the concept called Kedusha Samakom, the holiness of place. You have that as well by Eretz Yisrael, Kedusha Saaretz. And that's why the Maharal speaks about in Source 50 and 51 that it's really based on the Pasuk, V'zacharti et Briti Yaakov, I'll remember my covenant with Yaakov, Briti Yitzchak et Briti Abraham, my covenant with Yitzchak, with Abraham, Eskor, I'll remember. And then the end of the verse says, Va'aretz Eskor, and I'll remember the land. So explains the Maral on his commentary in Pirkei Avos, that not only will God remember the land in the merit of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but the land itself has its own merit because Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov became who they became because of the land. If you Jewish people aren't going to treat the land properly, so then you're not worthy of being in the land. It's not just the land itself has in it a tremendous amount of power that it has the ability to affect the people in the land. As we know the famous statement that Avir Yisrael Machim, the air of the land of Israel makes you wiser. The land itself has a certain holiness. And the Osayim Torah in Shemot brings down such a wonderful insight, I must share with you, about the land. He says, don't treat the land of Israel lightly. There's a wonderful statement of the Medrash, where the Medrash says, Mi shehoda ba'artso, one who recognizes and acknowledges his land, nikbar ba'artso, is buried in his land. Umi shelo hodar ba'artso, and one who doesn't recognize the land, lo nikbar ba'artso, won't be buried there. What's a classic example the Medrash brings? Yosef HaTzadik and Moshe Rabbeinu. When Yosef was taken and thrown into prison, it was referred to about him that Ganov Gunavti Merita Ivrim, I've been stolen from the land of the Hebrew. Right? He's always known as a Hebrew. Ah, he's always connected with his land. Yosef HaTzadik's bones were buried in the land. They were schlepped along for those 40 years. Moshe Rabbeinu runs away after killing the Egyptian. He runs to the well and he saves the daughters of Yitro. And what does the Torah say? That the daughters of Yitro said to their father, you know what? Ish mitzri hitzilani hayom. An Egyptian saved us. Ah, he wasn't referred to as coming from the land of Israel, but rather from the land of Egypt. He wasn't worthy of being buried in the land. So you read this Medrash and you say, as the Yavim, the Torah mentions, well, give me a break. Where was Yosef from? Israel. Where was Moshe born? Egypt. What do you want from him? He never was in Israel. Why should he say something he never was? Why should he be connected to something he never was? Says to the Zayim, the Torah, the following. So he says, Echu ne'anash al shakafar ba'artso 44, lo ba'amoach ba'artso. It's not even that he denied his nationhood. It's talking about the land itself. Misha hoda ba'artso, he who admits who comes from this land. But he says the following. Three lines up from the asterisk. Source 54, let's do it inside because it's great. Ume'az adsof kol adoro. From the time that Avraham Avinu was promised at the Brit Ben Absarim, the covenant of the peace, until the end of time, we were promised the land of Israel. Kishesholim et ish Yehudi. When you ask any Jew, and it doesn't matter from which land he is, he's European, he's American, it doesn't matter. Me'eza eretz ata, where are you from? Says the Oznayim Torah, it's wild. Alav lano, you should answer, Me'eretz Yisrael ani, I am from Israel. Af shelo haya sham me'olam, even if he was never there or his parents were never there. He should answer, I'm from Israel. I am right now in another land waiting expectantly to go back to Israel. This is the connection that we should have with the land of Israel. The land itself has importance, not even as a national identity, I'm a Jew, but that I come from the land of Israel. It reminds me that when I was in more of my Zionistic mode as a child, 16, 17 years old, I came back from a summer in Israel, even before I read the Sozayim Torah, and I was coming back myself, I was on a group trip, and you have to fill out these papers to get into the country. So the person says, well, where are you from? I said, from Israel. She says, well, you're filling it out as an American citizen. That's right, but I'm really from Israel. So I was giving this, you see, I was a little bit of an idealistic kid. So we got to this whole discussion. Well, where are you really from? I'm from Israel. I happen to be here, but I'm from Israel. So finally the lady said to me, well, where's your library card from? They was even younger. They was 15. So that's what the Zion Torah is saying. That's your response is that you're from Israel. And I think that this is what the law of Shemitah teaches us. is teaching us the importance of the land itself. The land itself has a certain kedusha to it, has a certain holiness to it, but not only a holiness, and it has a life of its own. It has a power of its own. It has an energy of its own, an energy to change the others, to change the forefathers, an energy that can change us. And that's why you can't but treat Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, with the appropriate amount of holiness. I think finally, if this is the way we need to treat a land, with real respect that we will give it its rest every 7 years or every 50th year, I think how much more so we need to learn from this, going back to that law, Onas Dvarim. If this is the respect we give to the land, can you imagine the respect we should give to people? This is the sensitivity that we need to have if it's going to be the sticks and stones, the sensitivity we have to people. And as the Pelayowitz notes, that if you want to know the measuring stick about how to speak to people, anything that would cause you pain, any statement, any slight, any insult, don't say it to another person. Not even in a mocking or joking way. And I think if you look at our own time with the tragedy that happened in Colorado, I think that's really a case in point. You pick on kids, you make fun of kids, even in a joking way, you see the detrimental effects it could have on so many people's lives. Joking around, making fun of people is really not the Torah way. Onas Dvarim is the sensitivity that the Torah demands. If we have sensitivity to the land, how much more so sensitivity to people? I'd like to close with one story, and then we'll summarize. Stories told about how 70, 80 years ago in Jerusalem, there was a yeshiva in Jerusalem where the boys didn't have a dormitory. They rented out rooms in different parts of the old city in order to be close to the yeshiva. So there was one woman who was a widow who had a son who used to rent out rooms to make money in her building. And she was really a nasty woman. And she used to turn off electricity Erev Shabbos or turn off the hot water Erev Shabbos. She did things to harass the boys. And she would say not nice things to them and scream at them. It was really unpleasant to live in her building. And the boys finally just couldn't take it. And one by one, what did they do? They found other rooms. Except for one yeshiva boy remained. One day, he's walking home from yeshiva with his sefer, and he meets this woman on the street. And she begins to harangue him. Why don't you learn from your friends? Why are you still here? Didn't you learn from them? You should leave my house. I'm so mean to you. So he turns to her and says the following. He says, I'll tell you why I'm not leaving. He says, you're all alone. He says, maybe one night you'll fall or you'll get sick and you'll need some help. And you'll cry out for help and there'll be nobody there. How could I leave you by yourself? And the woman just broke down. And she apologized profusely. And he says, don't worry, I understand you're a bitter woman. You're a woman who suffered. How can I blame you for the way you've treated us? This is just your way of getting out your aggravation. And that changed her whole mode, where she suddenly became a much warmer and nicer person, and the rest of the yeshiva students came back into her building. But the story ends that he never would walk in the front door lest he would meet her, because she was always embarrassed by their conversation and always apologizing to him. And he didn't want to make her feel uncomfortable. This is what we're talking about, Jewish sensitivity. That there is to be seen beyond the person, to see what's causing this pain, to be sensitive to that, to be attuned to that, to become a person who's going to be sensitive to the needs of others and how we treat others. Ma'inyan Shemitah al-Har Sinai, why was Shemitah chosen? First approach is because Shemitah doesn't happen that often. There's an excitement, there's a newness. And that excitement and newness is the reason why they were thrown off the land. Shabbos also has that excitement and newness. Approach number two is both Har Sinai and Shemitah, where we have to give up our intellect, so to speak, or a real part of ourselves and give it over to God. And that's that both a dialectic that we have in life where we want to move forward, yet we have to retreat as well. And we have to understand that when we retreat, we're really going to reach a higher level, and that's why it's in the schus of Shabbos and the schus and the merit of Shemitah that we're granted the next 7 days, or next 6 days, or the next 6 years. And that's why Shemitah is included, because if you're not going to keep Shemitah, so then you're not going to be given the gift of the land. And finally, the power of the land itself, that the land itself has feelings, that the land itself made Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov so great, and therefore you'll also be thrown out of the land. And I think this is the lesson that we need to be learned from the whole idea of today, is the concept of sensitivity. Let's look into the law, what it means to be sensitive to another person, what it means to be sensitive to the feelings of another person, and even when we walk down the street, to be sensitive that the way we look, our demeanor, has an effect on other people. And that's the power of Shemitah that teaches us so many lessons.